So welcome everybody to the Q&A for February. Coming to you from lovely Bel Air. For those of you in cyberspace, we had a great week this week at AJU. We had the rabbinical students, not only from Ziegler, but also from the Jewish Theological Seminary. That's a conservative institution in Manhattan. And they were here together for the seniors in the program who are looking for jobs, and we had congregations from all over North America who came to have interviews with them. It was a wonderful example of togetherness, and the week has now ended and was a great success. So today's a Q&A, so I'm going to turn it over to any of the students present who have questions they want to raise. All will sit in silence.
So in Mishnah Megillah 2:1, which is what we're working on in class right now, we came to this thing that says, so if you're reading the Megillah and you read it out of order or all of these other reasons, like, you're not chosen. If you read it translated into a language that you don't understand, not chosen. But if you are a foreign language speaker and you hear it in Hebrew, somehow you are.
Is Hebrew magic, and how come you're not allowed to read the Megillah in a language you don't understand unless that language is Hebrew? So I have my boring answer, and then I have my real answer. The boring answer is the accurate one. So I think the accurate answer is, I don't think it occurred to anyone writing the Mishnah that any Jew would not understand Hebrew. So it just didn't occur to them. But I think the more interesting answer from our perspective, and one probably not the pshat of the Mishnah, is, yeah, I think what it's saying is that Hebrew is your Yerusha, your inheritance, whether you speak it or not. And that every Jew has a Hebrew inflected soul. And so there's a way in which when we learn Hebrew, we're just awakening a dormant part of ourselves that's already ours, rather than acquiring something that isn't ours. You go out and you learn Italian, you learn French, that's awesome, that's great, and it's expansive of yourself in that you're taking on something that wasn't there. But learning Hebrew is not the same. Learning Hebrew is taking something that's asleep in your soul and waking it up. And so in that regard, even if you hear the Hebrew without consciously knowing what it is, I think it speaks to your depth. I'm assuming that would be a different way of reading it. Certainly, I hope that's true. I just got an app that lets me listen to Hebrew talk radio, and I'm hoping that even though I miss a good 50% of it, that it is awakening something dormant and valuable in me, because otherwise I'm wasting an awful lot of time on the 405.
There was another school shooting yesterday, and so two questions. One, how do we not stay dumb and actually do something? Is it possible to do something? And number two, as rabbis, how do we address that to our communities?
Okay, so there was a horrific shooting yesterday in Florida, and of course our hearts go out to everyone in the community, and thanks to all the people who are in law enforcement and the police and the healthcare people and the therapists and the clergy and the teachers, and I'm probably leaving people out, but everyone involved in helping bringing some sanity and healing back to that community. And here's a couple things I want to say. The first is, could we please stop being surprised? Could we please stop acting like this is unexpected? Right? This country is so overarmed, and to keep offering the same sterile solutions, that to me is a clinical definition of insanity. So let's stop being surprised. And while I generally believe, I'm going to rephrase, I do believe my rabbinate is one that strives to be nonpartisan and not to invoke partisan responses to social problems. At the same time, I hope that my rabbinate is one that is acutely conscious of social justice issues and mobilizes Torah wisdom to advance social justice. So you understand there's some tension between those two goals. In this case, I think our tradition is pretty clear about prohibiting murder. That's one of the top 10. That's a sin. Right? And putting weapons in people's hands that can only be used for mass murder strikes me as socially criminal. So I will now allow myself to say one explicitly political, although I will say it in a nonpartisan way. If you're not registered to vote, and if you're not actively involved in reshaping the upcoming congressional elections, then for the next 2 years afterwards, you are not allowed to complain to me about anything in society. You understand? Because in the off years, it's all about the congressional elections, and on the on years, it's all about the White House. So if you're sitting it out, the congressional election or the presidential election, you have abdicated any right to have any response on any issue of concern to yourself that's social, right? Because that's 100% of what it is. If we take Congress and we elect Congress people who think it is intolerable to have school children shot at, it is intolerable to have parents dropping off their children and thinking their kids might die at school today. If we elect Congress people who are willing to have that happen, then we will get the outcome we've elected, right? And everything else is window dressing. Spare me your prayers, spare me your hand-wringing. I'm done with hand-wringing. We need to elect officials who will take this seriously.
In recent time, I've been going to bed and waking up kind of teary-eyed, both what's going on in the world and just, you know, the daily stresses of life. And I'm curious, while I'm doing this, is God crying with me, or does God cry in general? Both perhaps of the happy time,
yeah,
and also of the not as happy.
So, those of you who have heard me talk on this subject know that I very much believe in an emoting God, in an empathic God. I believe in a God who feels our pain, and I believe that we can cause God pain, and I believe in a God who celebrates our triumphs and who we can help rejoice. So it's in our hand to please God and to torment God. And I believe that God not only cries with us, but through us. So our terror and our panic and our despair, they're not just causing God pain, they are God's pain. And I would imagine that one of the measures of God's vast and impressive strength is this is not the first generation to cause God torment. I think humans have been doing that for as long as we've been humans. Hopefully, we also make it worth God's while in the joy side too, but these are exceptionally trying times and very painful.
How can we, both as Jews and as people in rabbinical school who have like a little bit of leverage in that sense, do things that encourage people to pay attention?
I love the fact that you think that being in rabbinical school gives you leverage. That's awesome. I won't address that point. How do we help raise people's consciousness and engagement on the DACA issue? So you remember what I said about the elections? Okay, I want to reference back to that. However important other activities are around DACA, if we don't win elections, it all gets erased, as we're now witnessing. So for those of you who don't know what DACA or Dreamers are, there was a program started in the previous administration to offer a kind of amnesty for children who were brought into this country and to give them a way to normalize their citizenship status. And the current administration has a very different perspective on immigration and security issues and has revisited this question in ways that's not at all clear that those people will still have a haven in the United States. I think one of the ways that rabbis can and should be intervening in this is to be pointing out every time the Torah mentions loving the stranger, and to point out that the stranger here means a non-documented resident. And, you know, that we're not talking about when you walk down the street and you don't know someone. That's not the gear it's talking about. It's talking about the people who are in your country without papers, or the people whose status in your country is not secure. And I think telling our story about having been ourselves strangers in Egypt and then trying to find our way to our own home, and that because of that, the Torah says we have a special obligation to know what it's like to be in that position and to identify with the people, not the ones who look like us, but the ones who are in the position that our ancestors were in. I think that's the most effective single thing we could be doing, is just telling that story, repeating those mitzvot. And everything else you do is a political choice you make. If you feel yourself called to protest, protest. If you feel yourself called to, I don't know, teach on the subject politically, go ahead. If you want to go to rallies, go to rallies. And if you don't, don't. Because the bottom line is, who are you putting in Congress in a year? And if those things will help mobilize the election of Congress people who look at children who've come to this country as threats or as assets, then that's what's going to make the difference. Ultimately, that's where the fight will be had, right? One of the things we learned from the last presidential election, regardless of who you voted for, this is not a partisan thing, this is just an objective political observation, is it's not about people's sentiment, it's about the system. And if you technically win the system, whether or not you mobilized mass support is absolutely irrelevant to a functioning democracy, right? It's about knowing the rules and then utilizing them. So in this case, immigration policy is made by the White House and by Congress. So focus. Others. Were you a slave in Egypt? That's great. So look, you well understand that the Haggadah says explicitly, behold or vador, right? In every generation, each of us are obligated to see ourselves as slaves in Egypt. One of the things I love about their commanding us that is that that implies it's not easy to do. Right? It's easy to pay lip service to, it's just hard to really take seriously. So I want to suggest a couple thoughts about slave in Egypt. One is, it's something we should be working on. Like, that's a spiritual task, right? Because it's hard. We all live, in various ways, lives of extraordinary privilege compared to 99% of humanity today and throughout the past. We live better than royalty. So to be able to cultivate the active mindset of knowing what that oppression might be like, that's an act of imagination, right? And I'm a big believer in a world informed by imagination and fantasy. So for me, one of the tools I use to be a slave in Egypt is I've spent, for example, the last 2.5 years reading a lot of African-American literature, right? Including slave journals. Here's a horrible confession and something I intend to write up at some point. When I went to Harvard, which is not a bad university to go to, and it may be different now, I went a long time ago, I majored in white studies. I didn't know that. That's not what they called it. They called it American history and literature. But it turns out no women wrote anything worth my reading. No black people wrote anything worth my reading. No Latinos. No, hardly any Jews. The only woman we read was Uncle Tom's Cabin. That was it. We read no black authors. And so it took, as an adult, saying, wait a minute, that can't be right, and going back and reading some of the best writing I've ever read. And let me just tell you that if James Fenimore Cooper can make it onto the list of things to be read, then frankly, any of these writers could be on the list, right? And if you don't believe me, Mark Twain wrote a brilliant, brilliant essay called The Literary Sins of James Fenimore Cooper. You absolutely should read it. It's hysterically funny and viciously nasty. So part of it then is I'm a slave in that way too, meaning I have white guys on the brain syndrome, right? Somehow I went to a school that made me think that that's normal, a world occupied only by white Christian men, right? And you never fully recover when you have that infection. All you can do is be mindful of it and contain it. So part of my I'm a slave in Egypt is my brain was enslaved, right? And so doing the work of reading women writers, Latino writers, African-American writers, because what literature lets you do is occupy the mind and the heart of another person for a while. So use that as part of your preparing for Passover. Don't just read Jewish literature. Pick up a slave journal. If you haven't read the memoirs of Frederick Douglass, they're incredible. They're incredible. I mean, first of all, the fact that this former slave wrote a book that I have to look up words for is mortifying, right? A Harvard graduate now has a smaller vocabulary than a brilliant former slave from the 1840s. That's terrible. But he talks about slavery, you know, and you realize a man as brilliant as he was looked upon as just property and not even valued property. Like, you get a sense of how monstrous it is. That's part of being a slave in Egypt. And then the other part is to read the paper in that way too. You know, I often drive through the city of Los Angeles, and when I see homeless people, I make myself say the words, that's someone's Jacob, my son, right? Who isn't them because of us, but could be, right? So if we can train ourselves to walk through the world looking at people who we're taught to overlook, to look past. These are the people you ignore while you're walking into the restaurant. These are the people you don't look at when you're running to the supermarket or out of the supermarket, or you go through the other exit so you won't have to deal with them, right? If we can train ourselves to look at them and think of someone we love and say, really, this is this, that's that person, that also will change our obligations to them and our relationship to them and then what we're willing to tolerate. So, okay, that's my, are you a slave? Good question. That's not a trivial question. It does make me want to hear you ask a trivial question if you thought that was one of them. Or maybe what I should do is hear a serious question from you, because that would be terrifying.
So if I was a slave in Egypt, then how do I contain the sorrow of knowing that my generation isn't the one that reaches the promised land?
So, look, here's the thing. None of us are part of the generation that ultimately reaches the promised land. You know, there's an old, not very funny Jewish joke about a town in the middle of Eastern Europe, and they're worried that when the Messiah comes, they won't know, right? Because no one is going to go call Yehupitz and tell them Mashiach has arrived. They'll just get ignored. So everyone will get whisked away to the land of Israel, and they're going to be stuck in the middle of the Pale. So they build a really high tower, and they hire someone, or they post a job announcement. We want you to just stand on the top of the tower and wait till the Mashiach comes. And then your job is going to be to tell us so we can all, like, run to catch up with everyone. And they start an interview, and the first interview they have goes fairly well. They offer the guy the job. They tell him what the salary will be, and he says, that's a really low salary. And they say, yeah, but it's lifelong employment. Right? That's the joke. So, you know, this we're all waiting for a Mashiach that isn't coming in our lifetime. Right? And so I think the Jewish solution to that is to identify with the community. Right? It doesn't have to happen in my lifetime. It has to happen to my community. And to have faith that the work that we're doing is advancing our steps towards the promise. And that's as much as humans are given. So if we can hold on to the footsteps towards on the journey and know that someone's going to reach it, and in their reaching it, I will be there too, right? I think of bringing Joseph bones, right? And there is a way in which that's who we are all. We are the bones that people will bring with them. But that's an arrival.
Sometimes, at least when I read the Torah, and there's things that seem outdated and, you know, gendered language and stuff like that, obviously you can understand it as it's, you know, from people who were in a certain time and place and context. But if I look at it as this is from God or inspired by God, whatever that means, there's something that Maimonides said that I like, which is, you know, if God speaks in the language of man, sort of baby steps, that if God was speaking in current modern-day language, we'd be overwhelmed. We wouldn't know. It's why we weren't led by way of the sea, right? We had to go around.
Anyway, right.
Do you think there's validity to that, or do you think, I guess, how do you reconcile those sort of, you know, gendered languages and stuff like that?
So there are several places where the Torah tradition pinches me. In fact, I recently put up an old talk I gave called The Bible is a Terrible Book and We Should Read It Regularly. So if you want to hear that talk that was given at ICAR a couple years ago. It's not just the gendered language that's hard. You know, I would have liked somewhere in the Torah to say slavery's awful and you shouldn't do it. That would have been, like, once would have been nice, you know. Maybe if once the Torah had said something against sexism or against homophobia, or, I mean, we all have a long list of, gee, wouldn't it, you know, I have an addendum to the Torah that I'd like to just propose. But here's what I want to say. So for me, that's one of the reasons why I think that believing in the literal idea of revelation, that, you know, God dropped this particular book with these particular words, is a non-starter for me. Like, it just literally seems beneath God. But if instead God is constantly calling us to a higher vision, then of course that higher vision will both be higher but also trapped in the language of our times, right? So my teacher, Rabbi Simon Greenberg, used to say that Thomas Jefferson was divinely inspired when he came up with the Declaration of Independence, right? I believe that, right? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Tom, come on, let's work on that. And yet, at the same time that was a product of his time, it was a vision that transcended his time, right? And I think so it's not surprising that the Torah uses the language of the late Iron Age to say things that are utterly radical for the Iron Age, and some of it is still radical for us today. So that's how I reconcile it. I think that any revelation is always both a product of its time and beyond its time. And that's true when God speaks through you, right? And God willing, in your lifetimes, you will also add to the heritage of Torah in ways that your great-great-grandchildren will look back and say, well, it's awesome, but really also, really, couldn't you have? Like, we will also say things that in the course of history will hopefully look stupid. Hopefully, we will also have said things that in the course of history will have been transformative, right? And in that regard, the Torah was one of the world's glistening transformative texts and a product of its time. Thanks, everybody.